Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to bridging the gap between adventure and adventurer by helping people select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Judge Brett Kavanaugh is the newest justice on the Supreme Court. His nomination and confirmation process was marked by controversy, allegations of sexual misconduct while a teenager, and suspicions of his lying about that to the Senate Judiciary Committee. His conduct while rebutting his accusers' claims also raised eyebrows as he careened between anger and emotion to his challenging to his challenging senators about their questions and raising concerns about his temperament and ability to be impartial due to his characterizations of those he felt were behind what he believed to be a smear campaign. Then on Saturday, the vote in the Senate resulted in protests outside the Capitol and inside the Senate chamber, as Vice President Pence repeatedly asked the sergeant-at-arms to restore order to the gallery. The nation is clearly divided, and with Kavanaugh's lifetime appointment, conservatives now have a solid majority on the high court. Given the great divide and a court that some view as out of step with the majority of the nation, what does the future hold? Has the drama surrounding the Kavanaugh nomination and confirmation sullied yet another branch of government? How much more of this division can the nation take? For answers, we've brought in a panel of political experts and Supreme Court watchers. Dr. John Schmier is a Supreme Court watcher. He's an associate professor in the Department of Political Science at UNC Charlotte, specializing in judicial process, politics, and the High Court. Welcome back.
Great to be here.
Dr. Susan Roberts rejoins us. She's a professor of political science at Davidson College. Good to see you again.
Good to see you. Thanks.
And Dr. Michael Bitzer is here, professor and chair of the Department of Politics and History at Catawba College. Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
You can join us, too. You can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org or search for WFAE on Facebook. Get to us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks. You can even watch us on Facebook Live. The U.S. Senate on Saturday voted 50-48 to confirm Brett Kavanaugh's nomination to the Supreme Court. He was sworn in moments later in the day, as a justice. But protesters were the order of the day on Saturday, both outside the Capitol, inside the Senate chamber, outside the Supreme Court when he was being sworn in. There were occasional outbursts in the gallery. How often has that happened in the past as the Senate has voted on a Supreme Court nominee?
It's fairly rare to have public displays and outburst in the Senate chamber. There's a norm to the Senate process. There's a norm to the environment. And generally, it is a very staid, very quiet kind of process. This showed the outrage that this particular issue and confirmation process brought out.
To get into the Senate gallery, don't you have to have an admission slip from a senator?
Usually you do, yeah.
So are we to assume that Republicans were responsible for some in the gallery as well as Democrats, or are they all Democratic people up there?
I wouldn't think they'd be Republicans. Yeah. I think it's interesting when you talk about the protesters, you know, the ability of Trump and McConnell to reframe the issue. The protesters are the mob. And he's reframed the issue, Trump and McConnell, into what was survivors of sexual assault, into it's scary for young men in the country. So their ability to kind of reframe the protesters into the mob, and we'll talk about this probably later, only fuels the fire, because that's what people hear.
And, yeah. And in particular, when it comes to the midterm elections, which, let's face it, much of this is, you know, a play that's going on to motivate what happens in November, midterm elections are usually driven by anger. One of the reasons why the president's party tends to lose, it's the party that lost the general election for the president that has the intensity and the anger and that mobilizes turnout. And so this is a risky strategy.
Yeah, but now you have anger on both sides.
That's right.
Right. And I mean, as John said, I think, you know, if you looked at it on a scale of 1 to 10, Democrats have gone from an 11 to maybe a 13 now. Mm-hmm. This has certainly given Republicans the fuel and the energy. My question is, can they sustain it for the next less than 30 days? Because they won, you know, and complacency is a factor in this.
Anger's about process now. Yep. But in the end, they can see things like Roe versus Wade being overturned, and that makes them happy. The Democrats see Roe versus Wade being overturned, and that makes them sad. So you have the anger about the process, and then you have the anger about the change in policy, and that's going to sustain the anger.
I would argue that the potential overturning of Roe v. Wade makes Democrats frantic.
Well, I think you know the Christian conservatives have said we're going to sit this one out unless the Republicans in the Senate really go after and protect Kavanaugh. And I think that perhaps a lot of people underestimated the furor, and it's been kind of just boiling on access to abortion. People are talking about what that means if they're going to overturn Roe versus Wade. And I think I use a book in my class, the Politics of Reproduction Seminar, and it's entitled Safe, Legal, but Unavailable. Mm. And I think that's the way, you know, you could look at it because the states have this patchwork quilt of all these regulations that make access to abortion very difficult, even in the face of Roe versus Wade.
And isn't that the strategy going forward? The Supreme Court will probably, correct me if I'm wrong, will probably not overturn Roe v. Wade, but they will give power back to states to control what happens.
I think you'll see the restrictions grow in terms of how abortion can be provided, whether you have to have an appointment at a medical facility, those kinds of things. Susan can speak more.
Waiting periods, gestational periods, private insurance, things such as, well, of course, parental consent, and what they call trap laws. Targeted provisions against providers. And as Michael was saying, you know, how large does a hall have to be?
Exactly.
Do you have to meet the standards of an emergency room? And this can effectively close clinics. And there are states where there are no clinics.
Well, but let's be honest, this is the status quo now.
Yeah.
You know, there are some states that have one, they think Mississippi, for example, is down to one.
Arkansas, I think, maybe.
And you know, it's been death by a thousand cuts, and that was when you had a more moderate swing justice who had voted to uphold the core of Roe with Justice Kennedy. And so now the question is it still death by a thousand cuts, or do they overturn it? If they do overturn Roe versus Wade, that doesn't mean that abortion is illegal. It just means that, you know, you'll have to go to a blue state to get an abortion.
So the last time the vote was as close as it was on Saturday, 50-48 on Saturday, was in 1881 when a guy named Stanley Matthews, we all remember Stanley Matthews, Justice Matthews, he was confirmed 24-23. How's that possible? Seriously,
well,
how's that possible?
You had fewer states.
They didn't show up? Okay. Anyway, does anybody remember why it was so close in 1881 and what impact Justice Matthews actually had on the court, if any? No one remembers.
I can answer the second question.
Does anybody
know why? And the second question explains why we can't answer the first.
Does anybody remember why it was so close?
Rancor. Partisan rancor. Answers
polarization.
So if it's 1881, it's probably the post-Reconstruction
era.
Battle between the North and South.
I could have looked it up, I suppose, but my point was to make – I was trying to make the point that maybe this too shall pass. This is all a tempest in a teapot, perhaps.
Go ahead.
So the first justice – the first nomination to be blocked was 1795. You had a justice who was impeached by 1805.
Okay.
We've had this partisan rancor the entire time. Sometimes it's simmering, and then other times it's boiling.
So it used to be that to confirm a Supreme Court justice, the Senate had to have 60 votes in the affirmative. I believe that's right.
Well,
to get past a filibuster.
To get past.
So why did that change? When did it change? And since this is a lifetime appointment, why shouldn't it be more than a simple majority?
Well, my recollection is that it changed in this context back in 2013 when or was it before 2013? I think it was before 2013.
It was
Harry Reid who lowered the threshold for the Court of Appeals
and district courts.
And district courts. But left the Supreme Court at the 60-vote threshold.
Mm-hmm.
Mitch McConnell becomes majority leader and decides if Harry Reid can rewrite the rules of the Senate for lower courts, we can do it for Supreme Court.
Plus, don't forget the 270 days or so that Merrick Garland waited without even getting a hearing by Senator McConnell and Senator Grassley's Judiciary Committee hearing or committee. So, you know, then you have Neil Gorsuch. You have a frantic and rabid Democratic Party who was not going to allow Gorsuch's nomination to pass. And so they had no choice.
So let's go back to the Mitch McConnell refusing a hearing for Merrick Garland, President Obama's nominee who was not given a hearing. They didn't even talk to him. They wouldn't even talk to him privately. He said that's because, Mitch McConnell said at the time, that was because it was a presidential election year and we should wait for the voters to decide the outcome of who was going to be the next president. Today, he's saying that if an opening happens on the Supreme Court in 2020, they will vote. They will bring the next Supreme Court justice into the fold. Why? That's a presidential election year. Shouldn't we wait to decide what the voters think about the next president?
Well, it's not that you can make it up as you go along.
Well, isn't he?
Well, I think that the precedent has been set. At least the bar has changed with midterms and the elections. That really has consequences that everybody's looked at in terms of so you can have a fast FBI investigation, so you have to hurry up. When you look at the court, and we'll see if it's tested, because people are saying perhaps Thomas might retire, Ginsburg is 85, Breyer is 80. Not that age, not ageism, but I think you have to consider that people might say enough, you know, I've really served my time.
Yeah. But I mean, isn't one of the great strengths of the United States Senate the fact that it's bound in traditions, and tradition seems to be falling by the wayside faster than you can use a toothbrush?
Traditions last as long as you want them to last. And if you want to win political power, you break traditions.
How often do they break? Have they broken tradition over the years?
So let's go back to the end of the filibuster for judicial nominations. The filibuster had been in place for 100 years.
Yes. My point exactly.
So yes, the Senate compared to the House of Representatives has been the more traditional. But traditions change because the environment around them changes. And our environment is changing and becoming more polarized and more political.
Well, if you want to think of something beyond that, it was in a column this morning by Charles Blow, and that is that some, you know, Republicans and conservatives are, you know, raising the question of another constitutional convention. I mean, that, you know, I've always said that's a political scientist's worst nightmare.
Well, isn't that, I don't want to be a conspiracy theorist, but this has been promulgated for a while, that you have to have a certain number of states. Legislatures mm-hmm. who are of one party or another and of like mind to hold a constitutional convention. And we're really close to that. And underwriting all of this political unrest has been the desire on the part of some, particularly on the right, to hold a constitutional mm-hmm. convention. Is that more than a conspiracy theory?
Well, I don't think it's more than a conspiracy theory. I think there are people that really think we need to fundamentally change the role of government and the size of government in our lives. And I want to point out, when you say the right, one could say the left, because we have really conflated ideology with partisanship. And you can truly say the right and the left. And I don't think it's, when we look at states that have the trifecta, I don't think I know the numbers right now, maybe 27 states that control, the Republicans control the House, the Senate, and the governor's mansion. So, you know, some things are in place.
Dr. Susan Roberts, a political scientist at the Davidson College. She is here with Michael Bitzer, chair of the Department of Politics and History at Catawba College. And John Schmier is with us, also associate professor of political science at UNC Charlotte. We will continue in a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that believe a car is used for more than just getting from place to place. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the outcome of the decision to confirm Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court. He was sworn in shortly thereafter on Saturday, so we now have a 5-4 split on the high court, conservative to liberal. At least that's the way it appears. Sometimes judges vote in a different way, so you never know. But Michael in Mooresville writes, stop, capital letters, stop with the false equivalencies. Reid changed the rules because the GOP stonewalled Obama's right to appoint judges and would have continued to do so. Harry Reid did not deny Merrick Garland a hearing. If you think McConnell couldn't have bulldozed through Senate norms, I have a bridge in Brooklyn to sell you. Did we say that Harry Reid stopped Merrick Garland?
No, but it's also a pox on both houses.
Yeah, okay.
Yes, sure. When they had the opportunity, the Republicans were obstructionists for Obama. And when they had the opportunity, Democrats were obstructionists for Bush. And Republicans obstructed Clinton. And Democrats obstructed George
H.W. Bush. And we can go back and
It's been going on for a while now.
And as, you know, we need to think, too. We talk about the Republicans and redistricting. We all know, I think, that the Democrats would do the same thing. It's about power and, you know, tit for tat, if you want to get to a vernacular.
Yeah. So I want to get back just for a second to this constitutional convention thing. I mean, do you think that's even close to becoming a reality? Do you think that's really an undercurrent that people on either side really want? That they want to rewrite the rules and change the shape of American government, given the fact that particularly traditionalists on the right want people on the Supreme Court who are going to be originalists, who interpret the Constitution the way the Founding Fathers, the way they believe the Founding Fathers intended. Did the Founding Fathers intend for there to be a constitutional convention and overturn the Constitution?
Oh, yes. Yeah, I think in many ways they
Thomas thought it Jefferson
would,
advocated.
They wrote it in. They wrote it in.
19 years, Jefferson wanted a new Constitution.
Convention.
Wow. Okay. Well, we'll stay tuned. It's going to get interesting in here. Alaska Senator Lisa Murkowski, after the vote, told reporters, quote, I don't know what you were doing when those voices were shouting. She's talking about the people in the gallery and screams and I'm sure tears. But I was closing my eyes and praying, praying for them and praying for us and praying for the country. We need prayers. We need healing. Does this outcome deepen the divide, or would a rejection of Kavanaugh have had an equally divisive impact?
It deepens the divide. It is so consequential, especially in this era that we can't change. I mean, we can't change the demographics. We can't change right now gerrymandering. We can't change measures about income inequality, social immobility. These things are there in terms of the atmosphere, and those things we can't change. It's one justice, but the long-term consequences. Lisa Murkowski also said there are issues beyond this nominee.
I thought you wanted to chime in there. No, okay, fine. By shepherding, and actually pushing, I guess, the Kavanaugh nomination through the Senate, Mitch McConnell, if you're on the Democratic side, looked like he was extremely political, bordering on being a bully. If you're on the Republican side, Mitch McConnell is a hero, did his job. Which is the more accurate picture if you take a 30,000-foot view?
Tell me which partisan lens you look through.
So it's completely partisan.
It's completely partisan. And I think, you know, we also have to talk about the fact that this seat, Anthony Kennedy's seat, while Kennedy was a center-right kind of leaning justice, he was somebody on key issues, gay marriage, abortion rights, other issues, that would side with the liberals on the bench. This appointment by one of our colleagues at Washington University, she looked at it and estimates that Kavanaugh will be in line with Justice Thomas, Justice Alito, and Justice Gorsuch. And so, you know, now that we have a very solidified right on the court, you know, the question in my mind becomes, what does Chief Justice Roberts do? And he is a conservative.
Sure. Yeah.
Well, but, go ahead. Sorry. But there's another narrative, right? There was an article in the Washington Post written by Larry Baum, who's probably the most revered scholar in my subfield. And what he suggested was, well, so Roberts has already started to move towards the center even before this. And you look at chief justices, they see it as their job to manage the institution. They don't have a lot of formal powers, so they have this sort of role orientation, and so they're concerned about perceptions of legitimacy and how people look at the court. And so what often happens is, if need be, they move to the middle. Warren Burger did it. Nixon appointed him. Everybody thought he was going to be extremely conservative, and they were going to completely destroy everything that Warren did, and it didn't happen.
Well, I think we could all address the fact that the cases before the Supreme Court soon will be cases that are very political in nature. Voting Rights Act, gerrymandering, executive power, and these have campaign finance. You can always look out, and you don't have to wait for a case about access to abortion to percolate up. They're there. You just have to choose them.
Talk to me about this, because people have said what you just said, that the 5-4 split on the court puts Chief Justice John Roberts in a tricky position and may, in fact, give him an additional measure of power. If you agree with that, why? Why would that give him more power? I can understand why, if he's concerned about the image of the Supreme Court and the trust that we hold in the Supreme Court to be fair and balanced, that he would try to keep things on an even keel. But how does that give him more power?
Well, it gives him more power in the same way that Kennedy had power, because he gets to control the outcome of the decision. So, for example, take LGBTQ issues. He wrote basically every opinion in the last 25 years that, you know, in 5 or 6 cases. And in each one, he got to write the law. And the liberals had to agree with him. So they got the outcome they wanted, usually. So same-sex marriages became legal, made it harder to discriminate against people based on sexual orientation. But he wrote the law. He wrote the precedent. And so that's the power that Roberts will get now. He gets to control whether it's a moderate decision or a very liberal decision or a conservative decision.
And some have suggested that he exercise this additional power cautiously. And that would seem to be right, because if he is trying to rebuild trust in the court, if he leans to the left, isn't he going to tick off people on the right? And if he leans to the right, it will just confirm the feelings of people on the left that the court is unbalanced and not fair.
Sure. And what Roberts also, and what most justices try to do, is to keep the scope of the ruling as limited as possible, because they recognize they are unelected, they are unaccountable, but they have to deal with the political winds of the time.
Well, I think, and we all know this, sometimes the court acts as a mirror reflecting public opinion, and sometimes as a beacon. Where do you want to go? And I think maybe right now the court's acting more as a mirror and not where do we need to go. And that is looking at public opinion, partisan opinion, and it really isn't a court that is so forward-looking as I would think. And they also really have the ability now to pick and choose their cases.
So really quickly, so I think the insight you can get is the first Affordable Care Act case, where Roberts made both sides happy and angry at the same time. And so he struck down the part that would force the states to participate in expanding Medicaid. And then he upheld the core of ACA, the mandate. I think that's what we're going to see.
Talk to me about the role of the Chief Justice. Where does that come from? Is that enshrined in the Constitution? Because it's actually surprised me. I guess I hadn't paid much attention to the Supreme Court over the years, because you pay more attention to
most
presidents.
People don't.
It surprised me that when the Supreme Court Chief Justice position came open, they gave it to a new guy. So seniority has nothing to do with being the Chief Justice. He just was put in as the Chief Justice. So how does that work? What is the role of the Chief Justice? What control or power does he have over his fellow justices?
It's dependent on how the Chief Justice looks both at the institution and as a colleague of the other 8 justices on the court. The one of the key powers that the Chief Justice has is when they go into conference and when they decide, when they hold the preliminary vote, the Chief Justice, if he or one day she is in the majority, they get to assign the opinion to a particular justice. They can keep it for themselves, or they can assign it to somebody. Now, you know, if they're in the minority, then the senior justice gets to make that decision. But that's a very powerful decision, as John said, that if you get to write the opinion, and remember, this opinion goes through stages of drafts that maybe a justice signs onto or doesn't.
And Kennedy wrote all those opinions because the Chief Justice was in the minority and Kennedy was the senior judge, so he made the assignments and he assigned them to himself. Roberts is now taking on the role as both the swing voter, so he will almost always get to assign the majority opinion, and that controls the outcome.
Yeah. Well, and as your listeners know, it's not just the decision. It's the reasoning behind the decision, right, why those opinions and the dissenting opinions are so essential.
And do other justices on the same side of the decision, because there's always a dissenting opinion, but on the people who are on the same side of the decision, do they get to sign off on the reasoning behind that, or is that purely up to the person who writes the decision?
So they can either just sign off on the reasoning, or they can write their own separate opinion called a concurring opinion, where they can describe sort of their alternative reasons for why they believe in the outcome that the court decided on.
Wow. The president on Saturday tweeted, "Women for Kavanaugh and many others who support this very good man are gathering all over Capitol Hill in preparation for a 3 to 5 p.m. vote. It is a beautiful thing to see," he tweeted, "and they are not paid professional protesters who are handed expensive signs. Big day for America." Clearly, he was insinuating that those who opposed the vote were just doing it for moneyed interests on the left. That certainly speaks to his base. What impact does that have on the rest of the country?
Well, I think you need to step back, too, and see what Kavanaugh said himself, that this was, I think, a choreographed, organized political hit. And that same sort of reasoning and tactics that Trump has used, and people would have to say, even people on the right would have to say he has bullying tactics. Well, Kavanaugh used the same ones. And when you look out there and you see the tactics and you say, well, there was a women's march on Washington
and
now the women protesters.
He was coached to do so by Don McGahn.
Yes.
In the White House.
Yes,
in the White House Council.
Yeah. McGahn didn't see the state, but McGahn expressed interest in the tone that the statement should have.
Very different from the Fox interview at the first.
Right. So Don McGahn, of course, is the White House
Council.
Yeah. Well, at least he is for the moment. The vote in the Senate, obviously along party lines, with one of the slimmest margins in history, Democrat Joe Manchin of West Virginia voted yes. He's facing a tough re-election challenge in a state that Trump won in 2016 in a landslide, and he sent an email saying, quote, "I have found Judge Kavanaugh to be a qualified jurist who will follow the Constitution." Will that help him in West Virginia?
I will say this. I wouldn't be surprised if Trump does not go to West Virginia and campaign against Manchin.
So why did he
say
that?
And McConnell has already said that.
Yes.
That this vote does not insulate Joe Manchin.
So why do it? Unless he really believes that Judge Kavanaugh is a qualified jurist who will follow the Constitution.
It's political calculus. So the question is, do you anger your base, and particularly women Democrats, but your base, or do you anger the moderates in West Virginia that might vote for you? And so he decided that he needed the moderates more than he needed the turnout in his base.
Is that based on polling, perhaps, that his campaign office has done?
Sure,
well, I would hope so. I mean, and we'll see this.
So it's not just
well, yeah.
It's not just guesswork. They think that maybe there are enough people out there who would be swayed by a moderate decision on his part to vote him back in?
Well, there had to be, because there are other red state Democrats that said, you know, I'm going to vote as I feel, not just the party, but as I look at it and say, this is not correct.
But if you're a Democrat and you're going to vote with Republicans or vice versa, why not vote the other party in to represent you in Congress if you got a Democrat who's just going to vote with Republicans anyway? Why not solidify that and make sure that they're always going to vote with Republicans?
Well, David Mayhew said one time that members of Congress are single-minded seekers of reelection. And that is true to a large extent. But at some point, wouldn't we like to think that there is something in terms of the trustee and not just the delegate? They're voting for something that they think is in the best interest of the country, in the best interest of a conscience. It's terrible to think.
Are they? Are they?
But let's step back.
Or are they just arguing for themselves to be reelected?
Lisa Murkowski did.
Lisa Murkowski did it, even though she voted present to kind of offset.
She voted no.
She voted no.
And she changed her vote because the person who would have voted
from Montana,
who would have voted yes, and balanced her vote, zeroed out her vote, was not there because he was attending his daughter's wedding. So then she changed her vote to present. What's the point of that?
Well, it's a norm in the Senate that if one side is lacking a senator, maybe the other side will pair with them and basically cancel each other out. It's a courtesy in terms of that. But to your point that you were talking about having solid Democrats or solid Republicans, remember this whole idea of polarization is because the parties have become so pure in that context. And people like Joe Manchin, people like Susan Collins, you know, those were seen as kind of the moderating influence. And now if you just want separate parties, we've got separate parties. That's not a problem.
I told someone that as Montana goes, so goes the nation with John Tester and Rosendale. And I think it is something. Tester voted against Kavanaugh. And that is one of those races, I think, that, and we've asked ourselves as political scientists for a long time, do campaigns matter? And I think we're going to see that this time around.
As Montana goes, so goes the nation. Should it be that way?
Montana, North Dakota, Missouri.
It used to be Ohio and Missouri.
I mean, Bill Maher on Friday night pointed out, and I forgot which state he chose that has no population. It might have been one of the Dakotas or I think it was Wyoming.
Wyoming.
Yeah. And he pointed to one of the senators, and he represents 537,000 people. Mm-hmm. Then he pointed to Kamala Harris. 20 million people. And they say, and he says, they have two senators. California has two senators. Is it time to rethink that? I'm serious.
Well, let's have a constitutional convention and let's go ahead and debate that, shall we? You know, and so, also increase the size of the House of Representatives.
So had Lisa Murkowski stuck with her no vote and had Joe Manchin voted no, that would have made the vote, I think, 50-50 with it. Mm-hmm. And so the vice president, Mike Pence,
would have voted
to break the tie. So the outcome was a foregone conclusion on this. What has this done to the reputation of the United States Senate as being, what do they call themselves, the world's most deliberative or best deliberative body?
Most deliberative body. They are the saucer to the heat of the cup that the House of Representatives
is. Are they still?
You know, after the hearings last week and the blow up by Lindsey Graham in the hearing, I'm beginning to think more and more, and Susan and I are teaching courses on Congress. I went in and said, look, the Senate's becoming like the House. And that's a dangerous road that we're moving down to in my estimation.
Okay, well, when we come back, I want to find out why that's dangerous, why the Senate becoming more like the House is dangerous. And we have a lot of listener emails that I'll share with you as well when we come back. We're here with Michael Bitzer, Susan Roberts, John Schmier, all professors of political science at various institutions known to you. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Dr. Susan Roberts is here from Davidson College, John Schmier from UNC Charlotte, Michael Bitzer from Catawba College. You just said, Michael, that the Senate is becoming more like the House, and that is dangerous. In what way is it becoming more like the House, and why is that dangerous?
The passions, the energy, the polarization has, you know, we talk about the members of the House and we as political scientists have seen the House kind of go in opposite directions. The parties have moved further and further away from each other. That's also happening in the Senate. And there's no willingness to work with the other side to perhaps find the moderate compromise, to be willing to compromise. Lindsey Graham, in his blow-up in the hearing, said, if I become chair of the Judiciary Committee, you can bet there will be a different day. And that was as direct a threat as I have ever seen a U.S. senator say to the other side, pointing his finger, yelling at them to say, you better look out.
Well, I think going back to the Federalist Papers where they made the distinction, why are the terms different for the House and the Senate? Really, the senators are insulated for 2 years right in the middle that they're not running for re-election. And I think it is one of those things, if you look at, they made reasons why the House could reflect the passions of the people, but the Senate, which many people have called for, you know, for a while, where good bills go to die. Yeah. And I think it is a big blow. And I think those hearings were disgraceful.
Well, getting back to the Constitutional Convention that we're
we've decided to call, apparently, let's go ahead.
Is it the reason, isn't part of the reason for this highly polarized environment the fact of there's a lot of money coming into reelection campaigns, and they spend most of their time when they're not on the floor on the phone, both sides of the Congress, House and Senate, raising money. And if you don't play to the party line, you ain't getting any.
A couple of things. First,
so is it time to lengthen the terms or limit, have term limits?
I have a simpler response, but first thing, let's not forget the Supreme Court's role in allowing, you know, the money to explode in terms of volume.
Yes, they did that.
But, you know, I'd go back to, you know, one of the not so trivial reasons for why we have that polarization, particularly in the Senate. And in the House, it's largely about redistricting. But in the Senate, there's no redistricting. They represent the whole state. They used to work 5 days a week. And so they were in Washington for like 270 days a year. And so at night, they had to socialize. Who do you socialize? Your friends from work.
Right.
And they, you know, Ted Kennedy would go to a bar with Republicans like John McCain. Yeah. And they would drink and they would have a good time and they would become friends.
Right.
And then it was hard to say the things that somebody like Lindsey Graham would say to his colleagues. They don't do that anymore. They work Tuesday to Thursday and then they go home. So, you see five or six Republicans, not even buying a house, living together in an apartment, but they work 12, 13 hours. Then they go home and they campaign the other 4 days a week.
Yeah. One of them sleeps in his office.
Yeah.
As a cop.
I do think that every now and then I want them to go home. I'm not a Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday club. But I think what they used to do besides just the bourbon and brunch, their kids played on soccer teams together.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And there was just some civility. Everyone would think, and they look at it and say, raising money is so tawdry, but they have to do it. And they can't just depend on PACs and super PACs.
Gerald Ford represented Michigan, and I went to high school with his children because they lived in Washington because he was there forever. Tweet from Reverend Stephen, or Rev Stephen, it says here. I'm assuming that's Reverend. Trump's attempt to reframe the Democratic opposition to Kavanaugh as the mob is an attempt to deflect from the New York Times piece that exposes his own mafiosa-style practices, and it further stokes the fears of his base that they are losing power in the country. Any comment about that? You don't have to. I'm just asking.
Well, I think if we look at it, I've always said that the red-blue distinction is a pretty blunt tool. But when we look back, the base has become one that is now energized. There are people that say they haven't been heard. It's curious because when you mixed that base, Trump's base, with the top of the ticket in 2016, we got one result. What's going to happen in 2018?
Jason emails, the position we are in is due to the constant coverage and instant soundbite news cycle. There was a time when it was okay to be moderate and work with others with whom you may disagree. The shock jock media coverage applied to our government has pushed our elected representatives to the fringes.
So, yes, 1987, you know, Congress does away with equal access. It used to be that if WFAE spent 30 minutes talking with a Democrat, they had to have 30 minutes talking with a Republican.
They did away with the Fairness Doctrine.
Fairness Doctrine, mm-hmm. Right. And so, you know, then that allowed Fox and MSNBC to happen.
That's right.
That allowed Rush Limbaugh to happen.
Well, the reason they did away with the Fairness Doctrine was that because you had to give equal time to both sides and broadcasters didn't want to give any time to any side because it was not commercially viable, The result was that nobody got to be on the radio or on television except on Sunday morning when nobody was listening or watching. And so they got rid of the Fairness Doctrine, so you can do whatever you want to, and so the media took sides.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Which I think has been very, very bad.
But it's been that way since the dawn of the Republic.
Guy emails, you must ask why the courts are so important to the left. It's because they've used the courts to pass public policy that they can't get passed through the ballot box. What about that?
Yes, and so do Republicans.
Yes.
Yeah.
but why do the courts? Well, do the, I mean, let's reframe that question. Are the courts important to the left? Because I know that the Senate obstructed Barack Obama in terms of appointing some of the lower court justices, but he seemed to have taken a more lackadaisical attitude toward pushing people into those roles because there was an enormous number of vacancies in the lower courts for a long time. And in just the last 2 years, President Trump has appointed and put into office, I think, at least 26 lower court judges and now two Supreme Court judges. Yep. There seems to be a great desire to put right-wing judges on the court by Republicans.
I think, and he's had an accomplice, and that is Mitch McConnell. McConnell has wanted to fill the vacancies.
But did the president, did they obstruct Obama, or did he simply not appoint people?
So there were all sorts of fun, one of the fun things about the Senate isn't just that they're, you know, that they used to get along, but they have all these little procedural tools. And so there were things like blue slips where you used to allow a senator, any of the home state senators from the lower court nominee state, to block the nomination just by filling out this blue slip of paper. McConnell did away with that earlier this year. Whereas, you know, the both of the Grassley did away with that this year. Both of the Judiciary Committee chairs under Obama held to that rule. So one senator could block a nomination. And we talked about the filibuster. That didn't go away until 2013. So Obama had to, you know, get past filibusters in 2011, 2012. There were lots of tools for obstruction.
So you're saying
we don't have now.
When the Democrats controlled things back when he was upholding the blue slip tradition
in 2000.
Why did they uphold it? Because it's tradition.
In 9 and 10, yes, but the traditions were slowly
eroding.
Why are conservatives who are tradition bound, one would think, eradicating traditions?
Because they have political power and they want to exercise
tradition
it.
With the power that you want. Yeah. I mean, it's...
Okay. Tradition's good when the tradition helps you.
Okay.
Which is why in 2020, McConnell might allow the president to nominate a judge and hold a hearing.
Okay. An anonymous email. The Republicans are the reason for the divide. Democrats are usually the reactionary and a step behind. Your guest discounted that the Republicans have been on a mission to take and make this country into a winners-only society where those that are disadvantaged have no place at the table. The Democrats did not start this, and the Republicans will continue to make this about politics instead of people. Your guests seem to be comfortable with that.
Well, I think that those issues about the Democrats and Republicans, let's just play devil's advocate here. Let's throw in, besides Democrats and Republicans, let's throw in Russian meddling in the election. Let's throw in fake news, some of the variables that aren't simply Democrat or Republican that really confuse the electorate.
Anybody else want to comment on that? You don't have to. Okay.
I think anonymous, if they were true about their feelings, names would be attached, but we're putting our names behind our statements.
I would say in terms of the politicization, both sides play a role. I don't necessarily disagree with, you know, the policies that the commentator was talking about.
Okay. There were concerns on the left about the appointment of Justice Kavanaugh and his belief that Roe v. Wade was settled law. Republican Senator Susan Collins seemed to believe that he was being sincere after she had a private conversation with him that it was settled law. Is anything really ever settled law, particularly when those who oppose that law take control of the court?
No. No. So the stare decisis is an informal doctrine for the U.S. Supreme Court, this idea that you're bound by precedent. The lower courts are to a greater degree because you can always appeal to the Supreme Court and they can enforce their own precedent. But there's no higher court to keep the Supreme Court in line. When it comes to interpreting statutes, Congress can overturn their decisions. When it comes to interpreting the Constitution, they're supreme.
So the Supreme Court can't wake up tomorrow morning and decide, we're going to get rid of Roe v. Wade. Cases have to come before it.
Right.
So will we now witness in the next few months a string of court cases that will force them or pressure them to take a case or two and overturn the previous decision.
Their case is out there, and they will. Let me just say one thing about Kavanaugh and access to abortion. He said that Roe was a precedent. He said it was important. And I think everyone would agree with that on either side of the aisle. Mm-hmm. But in a case not so long ago, he did say about a 17-year-old young woman, undocumented, that she, in a dissenting opinion, he translated that into an immediate abortion on demand. And I think that's an indication that there's he's not going to really come into this just waiting to see the merits of a case. I think he was predisposed, and all of us. It was a legal fiction for us to say Trump didn't know. He was looking for both someone from the Federalist Society and someone that was pro-life. He told us that in the convention election.
So during Brett Kavanaugh's rebuttal to Dr. Christine Blasey Ford's accusations and that second hearing, people have accused him of displaying extreme partisanship in his attacks on Democrats, in the way he treated some Democratic questioners, in the way he accused the Clintons of being involved in this attack on him. And some have said that showed he clearly could not or would not take a nonpartisan approach to considering cases. Do you think that's true?
So it's something to be concerned about. Various biographers of Clarence Thomas, who went through a similar set of accusations and a hearing that was similarly divisive, he maintained his tone, and yet the biographers still suggest that process hardened his ideological and partisan beliefs. Mm-hmm. And so I think at a minimum, if Kavanaugh perceives himself as a victim of this left-wing conspiracy, that it's going to harden his beliefs.
I mean, to viewers on television, it may have looked like theater, but for him, it had to be traumatic.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I mean, think about his daughters, think about his family. Those were not crocodile tears he was crying. That was real emotion there. So clearly, this is a traumatic event that will stick in his head mm-hmm. for the rest of his life.
I don't see him feeling like he's damaged goods going forth. And I think you would say the same thing.
Do not see him as that.
No, I don't see him thinking of himself.
Won?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And he went, supposedly, in Saturday to kind of review for the cases coming up. And, of course, we all know this. It was traumatic on both sides. Dr. Ford, the testimony on both sides, that it was credible, not that they believed it, but it was something happened. And it was traumatizing for her as well.
Okay.
So for Kavanaugh, though, the best theory we have right now about how Supreme Court judges decide cases, it's based on ideology, but they don't know it. And so I think, if you harden their ideology in their head, what happens isn't, okay, now I really feel Republican and I'm really angry, so I'm going to decide against the liberals. But he's going to subconsciously mm-hmm. perceive the law in a way that leans towards the right.
Stephen Gillers, a law professor at New York University, said Kavanaugh's testimony pulled the cloak off the Wizard of Oz. The court has a mystique all its own. Kavanaugh's behavior at the latest confirmation hearing shattered that mystique. It's going to be hard for the court to come back from that. If you agree with that, what happens when loss of trust in the fairness of the judiciary lessens, even as our faith in the other institutions of government is also declining? What happens?
Let me just point out one little thing that doesn't really address your question directly. We were all going, Senator Coons and Senator Flake were actually friends. And I think Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Justice Alito were actually... were actually friends. They liked one another. Yeah. They enjoyed one another's company.
They went
company.
To go to the opera
the
together.
Opera.
So you're not going to answer my question. So we now have two justices. We now have two justices on the Supreme Court, of whom allegations of sexual impropriety have been leveled, Kavanaugh and Justice Thomas, innocent or not of those charges. What does that do? And I have 30 seconds to the moral authority of the Supreme Court.
So I think particularly when it comes to sex and gender-based issues. It's going to be something that's raised every time they make a decision.
Yeah.
Definitely compromised.
Yeah.
Okay. Do you fear for the future?
I fear for the future when I wake up in the mornings, but I tend to go to bed at night and wake up the next morning, so I think things will be fine.
Well, it's not apocalyptic, but no. It's bad.
We all need a good dose of I Love Lucy, isn't we? Michael Bitzer from Catawba College, Susan Roberts from Davidson College, John Schmier from UNC Charlotte. Thank you all for the hour. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to helping customers select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.